Friedberg of Niagara Capital. With me is Al Friedberg. Today is May the 2nd, 2013. Good morning, Albert. How are you?
Good morning. Fine.
Beautiful day in Toronto. I've got some wonderful questions that have been put to me by clients. I hardly have very much work to do except just to pose them to you. But before I do, I got to congratulate you on what I thought was a terrific quarterly report. You really spoke in a kind of analytically mosaic way, and many clients wrote me to say as much. So good on you. Thank you.
You mean mosaic as coming down from the mountain?
I would say that was my implication.
All right.
Exactly.
All right.
Let's leave the most posed question till the end to keep our listeners waiting, and that would be about the gold. And let's start with another commodity and talk about crude oil. You have a bearish view on crude oil, but you've expressed it in a rather, how shall we say, prudently complex way. Could you speak about crude oil, please?
Right. We think that, though, I think that oil is one of those commodities that after many, many years of trading at very, very rich prices in terms of its cost of production, it's starting to crumble. The whole pricing structure is starting to crumble. I think that we are now, as a result of these high prices in the past 25 years, we are finding oil in unsuspected places, and supply is rapidly rising, and usage is actually diminishing in many areas around the world. In fact, some of the latest reports are that usage is flat practically. So our view is that oil is on its way down, and this is leaving aside any questions of whether we're able to make changes to the hybrid cars, for example, the very successful hybrid cars, and we can move them closer a little bit to a full electric car, leaving aside any of these technological breakthroughs, just supply and demand, natural gas, the fact that we found enormous amounts of natural gas, the fact that natural gas is selling so much cheaper on an equivalent basis to oil, that we are using those techniques also for oil, tells me that we are clearly on the way down. And we've been betting on that for now well over, I'd say, a year and a half. Our fear has been always, all along, that some kind of a military conflict would ensue in the Middle East and would have a strong short-term impact on the market, and we didn't want to be exposed to such a large fluctuation, such a large adverse fluctuation. So we've been keeping a short position by a hedge short position. We've been hedging that short position in a way, and that is actually eating into our profit. We have been making money, but it's not a clear downward path. But at any rate, the strategy has been working, and I believe that we're probably close to some type of a resolution in that military question. We believe that it's probably a matter of a very short time before something happens in Iran, and therefore we should be able to have an outright short position subsequent to that and benefit fully from the move down. Even without it, though, we believe that we can still make money, even with hedges on.
So I assume then that you're speaking, as far as the political aspect of it goes, the recent events about the American administration's, muted or less than direct response to the accusations of the Syrian conflict having devolved into the use of poison gases. And I'm also assuming that you're speaking about that the weakness comes from the supply side, not the demand side. And I'm also assuming my third assumption is that your hedge is really expressed by being long Brent and short in West Texas. Would all this be accurate?
Right. Long. Yeah, you're right on all three. And the last one, we are long Brent against West Texas, which is more like a domestic U.S. market. with difficulty in going out and in leaving the North American continent. And so it's trapped, and it's trapped in a certain area, and it's putting pressure, downward pressure on prices. But also it's the ratio of what we long is short. So our ratio is preponderantly short. So the hedges are structured in such a way that they do not eat into a falling price structure.
Okay, thank you. Let's talk about some broader macro themes. You've been for an awfully long time long housing. The housing sector has been, if not the main, certainly one of the main focuses of the long book of the Global Macro Fund for an awfully long time now. Now, many good analysts feel that it's outrun itself. It's as though we're back to pre-2008. P ratios, price-to-book ratios, seem to confirm that kind of view. Why are you still there? What's your take on it?
We think it's a great story. We think that the Fed policy of making money cheap and of lowering the cost of mortgages is making it possible for us to have a phenomenal boom in housing, and we see it in the price structure or what's happening in the price side. It's not just a question of volume; it's a question of prices, and we're starting to see a very large increases in prices. I believe that the last numbers show that prices increased 9% year over year, and we're looking for prices to increase in the double digit area, and maybe 25-30% by next year. So it's a price game, and I think that it's a margin game, and the housing companies will make a lot of money. They'll make a lot more money producing less housing than they did in the early 2000s, in the early decade. And there's a big profit margin ahead for them, and I think this is still early in the cycle. And they happen to be, according to the way we look at things, they happen to be probably the most or the best beneficiaries of Fed policy.
Well, in your letter, I think the main theme of your first quarter letter was precisely this, that Fed policy and central bank policy in general was, while it was an attempt to generate a wealth effect that would ultimately kickstart the economy, the ultimate effect was going to be merely, and I think I'm emphasizing your emphasis on merely the creation of bubbles, global bubbles in the United States, the prime one being housing. Could you elaborate on that? I'm thinking especially in this past month, of a kind of consensus shift away from austerity, the recent attack on the Reinhardt-Rogoff paper, which seems to aid those people in Europe who want to remove themselves from austerity. Is this all playing into your theme?
Yeah, let's start with the fact that monetary policy is really ineffective, and that we knew. We knew that from theoretical economics. Monetary policy is ineffective in raising output in the long run. It can raise output in the very short run if it catches economic participants by surprise, if they're not sure why this is happening, why demand is rising, and they think it's a real effect, they will be caught, and then you get a bit of a spurt in production. But very soon prices adjust, and once prices adjust, you lose that output increase. So it's clear to us anyway that monetary policy is not the way to go to do something about the stagnation of the global economy. And the only thing that it does do is it increases monetary balances and it makes people feel maybe wealthier, and we mark up prices. And naturally, the prices that you mark up the best are the ones that you can buy on easy terms, and nothing can be bought in easier terms than a house where you can get 30 mortgages at fixed prices or at fixed rates. So generally, and we've seen this everywhere. We've seen not just in the U.S., but we've seen the great booms that developed in Denmark and in Netherlands and in Canada, in Australia, all these places have seen enormous rises in house prices because of very easy monetary policy. So we have nothing to gain except bubbles from this, and those bubbles are very, very painful because as they deflate, as we're finding out now, and Denmark is undergoing now the third recession in 4 years, as prices are falling now, slowly falling. So is the case in Canada. Prices are slowly falling, and so as prices fall, you begin to have a reverse effect, or you know, in a way, a certain depressionary effect. So we gain nothing out of easy monetary policy. All we're going to get now is a huge, gigantic bubble, and part of it is real estate, part of it is securities, equities that pay any kind of return. People are not able to measure properly the risk today anymore, or they're not willing to take into account risk, and if it pays 2% or 2.5%, that's good enough, and so they'll buy junk bonds at 5% and not taking into account the fact that risk are such that in the end you're not going to make money out of the 5%, or you're going to make less money than you would make in treasuries. So monetary policy is the wrong thing to do. So now, leaving that aside for a moment, and now we come to the question of austerity, what's called austerity. Austerity has been practiced in the past 4 years in a very funny way. What governments have done, in mostly they have raised taxes and cut spending very, very little. And that's the wrong way of doing of practicing austerity. We're getting a larger and larger government sector in the economy, and we know that government is not productive. We know that government has problems, that the government intervention in the economy, as benign as it wants to be, it's just not an efficient way of doing things. And so government is dead weight on the economy. Government, the larger the government is as a percentage of the income of the country or the economy, the more it retards it retards economic activity, or it slows it down. So that's exactly what we've been practicing for the past 4 years. Larger governments, because they keep raising taxes, and then they say that in the name of austerity they're doing this, and of course it hasn't worked, because what has happened is that these economies have all stagnated or actually contracted, and debt as a percentage of that contracting economy has increased. And so now they're saying, well, you know, we've seen some studies that say that it's not important how much debt we have as a percentage of the GDP. We need growth. But how are they going to go about doing the growth? If the market allows them to do that, and we're not sure the market will allow them to do that, because some of these countries like Portugal and Spain are reaching levels of debt that are very serious problems today. So assuming the market allows them to do that, they're going to they're not going to lower taxes. Most likely they're going to increase spending. So once again, we're going to see a cycle of government increasing its size in the economy. And once again, we're going to see, and once again, it's not going to work. So I think that the recent scandal with that paper, which is not such a terrible scandal, but it was a minor mistake and they're making too much out of it. But it's encouraging many of these countries to abandon austerity plans, but they never practiced austerity to begin with. And so whatever they're going to do now, it's also incorrect. So economic prospects are not great. What we have in front of us is, and we can talk about it more later, but what we have in front of us is a period of accentuated bubbles in certain security markets and real estate, and economic contraction almost all over the world. That's really the effect of policies that are taking place today.
Let's speak specifically starting with Europe. bond spreads retreated to multi-year lows. How is this all going to play itself out there?
Well, here you had another case of politicians actually violating the spirit and the letter of the law, finding ways to finance, to do actually fiscal financing when something that should have never been done, promising that they will buy, let's say, Spanish and Italian bonds and Portuguese bonds in unlimited quantities. And then they, of course, qualified it by saying if they sign some type of a conditional agreement, trying to follow patterns themselves after the IMF. It's something that it's not in the books. It's not something that's permissible, and it's way beyond what the ECB was designed to do, which its only function is to maintain the value of the euro. And now will be the question: what happens if Italy and Spain, as an example, decide to abandon their austerity plans and move to spend more money? Will the ECB's undertaking still be effective? But until now, the market has been seduced by the ECB's commitment and have become very complacent, and have decided that that spreads were too high and have been driving them down to what we think are crazy levels. Just crazy levels.
Yeah, I think that most people would agree, but in the chase for yield, the pursuit of yield has obscured credit risks entirely, as they have elsewhere. What about if austerity is abandoned by Italy and by Spain, and they then come into conflict with the ECB? What do you think is going to happen? Will the euro break up? Can you imagine a scenario?
I don't know. I know there is a challenge now, even to. I understand the ECB, not the ECB, the Bundesbank, as a member really of the ECB, but the Bundesbank has now gone in front of the Constitutional Court in Germany, arguing that the ECB has overreached, and this is even before the ECB makes a decision regarding whether these countries are now following the conditions required for financing. So I don't know how it's going to play out, but I would think that if the Bundesbank prevails, you're going to see a movement for Germany to maybe exit. And whereas last year, for instance, I thought that the most likely event would have been for the weaker members of the European market or the European common market to leave the Eurozone. I'm beginning to think that maybe it's more like a 50-50. It's even just as possible for Germany to leave. It's clearly beyond what they ever expected, and it's hard for me to see how the German public will accept it after everything comes out in the open.
So I think what you're saying is that from an investor's point of view, it's a very difficult difficult environment to play, to bet on. It's really as difficult as it is to buy securities because credit risks are masked. It's also very difficult to predict how it will unwind itself. Would that be your view?
Right, exactly. We know that something will happen. We know that this cannot continue indefinitely. We know that at some point there will be a challenge to what the ECB is doing. We know that at some point the market will challenge these countries that have enormous amounts of debt. But we know that something will happen, either some type of forced default or a renegotiation of the debt, or just simply an exit. Anything like that can happen. And it can happen suddenly in Europe. And if it does happen, I think it can have a devastating effect on global markets, because they're not prepared. Global markets are not prepared. I mean, if we look at the spreads, the spreads are telling us that the market's extremely complacent, and something sudden like that can wreak devastation with the market. Now, on the other hand, just not to leave you on a bad note, on a terribly depressing note, if we get a resolution of that sort, even if it's a disorderly, chaotic resolution, I think that it will clear the way for some very interesting investment opportunities. I mean, Europe is still not disappearing. It's not going underground. It's still there, and there's a lot of very good companies there operating, some with multinational reaches. So there's a lot of good value in Europe, and clearly if it was managed well, there's a lot of excellent value there. There's a lot of good value in countries like Germany, too. So a resolution of the crisis after the initial devastation, I would say, could leave us with a very interesting scenario and with a lot of profit opportunities. Now, the U.S. would also suffer, I would say, and the U.S. is already suffering a slowdown. Part of it has to do with this, with the global slowdown, and the U.S. too will do better once we have a resolution. So resolution is important. So it's not something to fear as much as it's something to take into account, because the markets will become extremely volatile at that point.
In the global macro portfolio, or the global macro portfolio is and has been structured to guard, to guard against a crisis that we can't pinpoint, but we assume is going to emanate from Europe. And the way you've done it is you've been basically had a long short portfolio, not an equity long short portfolio, but an asset long short portfolio for quite some time. And it, presently, the short side of that portfolio is in stocks in general. You're long Google, you're long housing, you're long the Bank of Ireland. All of this is a matter of public record. But you still have a relatively substantial short position, your net short stocks via indices. And that short position, which, as I say, is designed as a kind of inoculation against catastrophe, has cost you a lot. What would motivate you to take that off?
I think that what we just talked about before, a resolution of the crisis, a significant resolution of the crisis, an event that would end this complacency, and that would see volatility indices rise much, much higher than they are today. The end of complacency would motivate us to take it off. Having said that, some of these markets, some of the markets that we've been short, for example, Brazil, we believe that on their own they would go lower anyway, regardless of whatever we think may be coming down the pipe. So we, on the short side, we have tried to find situations that we believe will be affected negatively, even if nothing happens, even if we muddle through. Short positions in stock like Gazprom, for example, which is a Russian energy producer, which is becoming not a competitive producer, pricing natural gas forcing customers to price natural gas at the price of oil, and the market beginning to resist that, and we see cracks in the pricing structure, and so Gazprom is wasting a lot of money and is going to suffer because of that pricing structure. These positions that we're taking, we believe, will do well regardless. There are other things that we have done that have cost us a lot of money. For example, we have bought protection in sovereign debt. We bought protection in Spain, and we bought protection in Portugal, and we bought protection in the subordinate debt of some European banks. Those things have cost also a great deal of money. There, if nothing happens, we will lose our money.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit different. And I discussed it in the letter. There were two types of hedges that we put on. It's only the latter that can actually be a total loss, and that's like at the cost of an option. The first, the former, going short markets like Australia or markets, like even the Canadian banks, which I understand there was an article yesterday in the paper about it. Canadian banks, we're not sure of Canadian banks because we think that they're poorly managed. That's not the case, and we don't think that they've made that they have huge hidden losses. We're sure Canadian banks because they are overpriced, simply overpriced, as banks around the world are trading at underbook because of problems, but also because of regulation, and because it's becoming harder and harder to make money for a bank. It's becoming very difficult for a bank to make money and leverage that equity base. Most banks operate on very high leverage to make money. 25-1, 30-1 leverage, and that's how they make money. And well, Canadian banks are operating on that kind of leverage too, and we think that franchise, the banking franchise, is really under a lot of pressure. And so on a valuation basis, we think the Canadian banks are overpriced. Will they suffer from the housing slowdown? I think they will. I think they will, and I think that will cause the market to revalue a little bit their idea of what a proper multiple should be. But it may not be devastating, but it was simply a movement from a cut in half of their multiple will be a significant move.
Okay, but let me put this to you.
What's that?
Sorry to interrupt you. Was there more that you wanted to make on that point?
I'm just saying that. I was mentioning the areas which we think won't do well in the next few years, even if we manage to muddle through. And now they've cost money, but in some of them have made money. You know, Gazprom has made money, Brazil has made money, India made some money, gave back some money last year, so we probably are even in that India bet. But Canadian banks, I think we're losing money. You know, but these things are views on the market, and I think that we're happy with them. It's the other ones that will cost a lot of money or are costing a lot of money. I mean, we already lost, I believe, something like maybe 500 basis points on the credit default swaps. That's a lot of money for us. 500 basis points.
No, I'm sorry that happened to us.
Yeah, me too.
But let me put this to you. Let me put a hard question to you. These short positions you have in Canadian banks, and I know you're short also Australia, Brazil, Gazprom, etc. Within the context of the portfolio, are these trades are these relative in the sense that? Like I'm trying to circle back to the idea that you would take off those hedges in the event that the European situation were resolved. So let's say today the situation were resolved.
No, okay, that's the point. I think those are positions that don't necessarily have anything to do with the European situation, resolution of the European situation. I think that they will create value for us regardless. It's the other ones. And that will make a difference if there is a resolution, and it's also the potential of what we can do after that's taken place. So, we are not likely to change our Brazil view if there is a resolution in Europe. That it, you know, Brazil has its own dynamics, its own economics. Is that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you. We try and keep we assume that everyone's busy. And we try and keep the call down to about 40 minutes. And I'm looking at my clock here. We've got about 5 minutes to go, and I think we should bring ourselves to gold now. A lot of the if the fund is structured so that it's an asset neutral fund today, the long side is composed of gold, or a goodly portion of the long side. Certainly not the entire long side, but a goodly portion of the long side is composed of gold. And it's been a very dramatic month with gold, 400 tons of gold, huge position sold in 2 days, 2 weeks ago. Gold, as one of our investors points out, being so volatile on the downside, loses its ability to collateralize loans, and has its nomination as money tarnished by that kind of volatility. And yet you still are bullish. And in fact, you've traded your way around the gold quite successfully until just this past month or so, going back many years. How are you feeling about it now?
Okay, first, two things. Number one, we did not see it coming. We did not see, clearly did not see it coming, did not see that very sharp break. And in retrospect, maybe I should have seen it coming. But, it was a market that was looking for a break. I mean, if you just look at the graph, the price chart before the break, market had touched 1550 or 1525 a number of times. It was looking to break it to what we call in the business trigger the stops. It was looking to do that. And the circumstances came, suddenly a shift in sentiment, a little story about Cyprus selling their gold, the idea that maybe other countries that need money will sell their gold, Goldman recommending a short position in gold. So everything sort of gelled together within a few days, and then the market went for the stops. Now, the ferocity of the sell-off was something incredible. I mean, you rarely see anything like that, and clearly, historically, we didn't see markets that move, or at least a gold market that moves 13% in one day. If we did, maybe we did see it for one day in January 1980, and that's coming down from the highs. But at any rate, so we didn't see it coming. That's number one. Number two, I feel extremely gratified that with that large position that we had a very small impact in the portfolio. It makes me feel that we structured the portfolio in such a way that it can take these kind of very, very large moves. So to me, that was even more important than the actual drop, the fact that we were able to survive it. And survive it without a noticeable impact on the NAV. Now, having said all that, our gold position is almost at its maximum of the amount of gold that we want to own. And as you know, and I've explained that, we've been doing it against the short position in stocks so that in a way we feel it's a bit of a hedge position, sort of. You know, it may be questionable. The idea being that easy money should do equally well for both, for stocks and for gold, and therefore net-net, we shouldn't really be making much money on that. But on the other hand, if there is a economic a tail event, a catastrophe of some sort, then, of course, stocks would head lower and gold would head higher, and that ratio would do extremely well. So we thought that maybe we purchase some kind of an option on the market. It has not worked out exactly as well. I think stocks have done better than gold, probably because they pay a dividend. Gold doesn't pay a dividend, or there may be another reason. But leaving that aside, I think that ratio is going to at least straighten itself out soon. And it is already straightening itself out. And the ratio is getting better, has gotten better for the last couple of weeks, and I think will continue to do better. But the interesting thing about gold is that as the economic crisis around the world picks up, as it keeps growing, as unemployment in Europe rises, as unemployment around the world rises, as China problems begin to develop because the Chinese are starting to stagnate, maybe the Chinese are going to see the same thing that happened to Japan after the 80s, a stagnation. The credit has increased phenomenally, and GDP is no longer increasing at the rate that they used to be. So it's very possible that the wheels of growth are grinding down, right? So we have problems there. We have problems in many other places. So as that happens, central banks were very conservative animals and who have enormous amounts of liquid funds at their disposal. I think we're talking about in excess of $10 trillion, and who are forced to have to invest that money. And they are forced to invest the money in safe and liquid assets, are finding it difficult to do that because they don't want to buy debt or they're reluctant to buy. Let's start with the first. About 60 to 64% of their assets are in U.S. dollars. That ratio hasn't changed much in the past 10 years, if I recall. And despite the fact that there's been a huge increase in reserves, so that means that they've made a concerted effort not to increase beyond the 64%. The rest is invested in euros a little bit and in yen a little bit and a few other currencies, maybe Australian dollars a little bit and Canadian a little bit, very small amounts. When you say invested in U.S. or invested in sterling or invested in Canadian, we are saying it's invested in fixed income and government income, right, government debt, and mostly short-term government debt. So it could be a two-year treasury. It could be a one-year treasury. It could be very short-term debt across the board. As the economy around the as the world economy continues to get to worsen, as the outlook continues to worsen, these central banks will have a difficulty in knowing what to do with the money. And it's become so now that every one of the central banks around the world that has accumulated large reserves has set aside an important portion into what's called sovereign wealth funds. This is a way of saying, look, international reserves are sacred. We can't play with this money, but we can set aside some of it in another pool, and that other pool can do other things and can invest money prudently. And countries have done that, and what they're doing is they're investing money in assets such as equities, right? Because equities are probably more attractive than fixed income. And so a portion of their international reserves is going into wealth funds, a portion, 10%, 15%. I don't know if it's gone to 20%. I don't think so. And even part of those wealth funds buy things like gold. But at any rate, we are now speaking about that portion, the overwhelmingly larger portion that stays in international reserves. And the question is, where will that money go? As we get more defaults, as we get other Greeces and other Cypruses and other Slovenias soon to come, the fear in the mind of these central bankers will be, what can I buy with this money and that I can be as safe? And then there's another additional factor, which is a sort of more like a political factor. Countries like China and Russia and Turkey, which have some animus towards the United States, or at least they have some, they have a competitive spirit in the sense that they want to control certain areas around the world, or they feel competitive with the United States. Are likely to want to own an asset that is not under the influence and under the thumb of the U.S.
Right, right, makes sense.
And that asset is gold. It's relatively liquid. It's not owned by anybody. It's not a liability of any country, and therefore it's the one asset that you want to own. And in fact, what's interesting is that the buyers of gold in the past year, the big buyers have been countries like Russia, and like Venezuela. Believe it or not, in countries that have had a difficulty living in our democratic family, right, in the global economic democratic family. So more and more of that will happen. They have a lot of reserves, and we're going to see, and we haven't seen yet the Chinese come in a big way, but we believe it will happen. So gold has a very bright future because of that.
Do you think that, and let's end with this question, if we may, do you think it's possible that the Bitcoin phenomenon may grow and it has many of the attributes that gold has? Do you think that it may take some of gold's place?
I don't know. I don't know enough of the Bitcoin. I don't understand it, so I don't know.
We have to do our homework. We're getting old.
Yeah. But it would be nice to see gold move as fast as the bitcoins.
Yeah, I agree. Al, thank you very much for your time this morning. Good luck in the second quarter, and congratulations on your good first quarter.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Bye-bye. This concludes our call. Thank you for listening.